sequential outline. We'll just review the subjects that we have ahead of us in the remainder of part one of the Agon. The purpose of the symbolic terms is to test and prove people that sincere may be known from the false. And that includes some examples, the changing of the Qibla and the homicide committed by Moses and the condition of the Virgin Mary. The ways of the manifestations are contrary to the desires of men. And these rapturous passages on the streams of utterance and the universe is pregnant and so on, we'll get to those. Continued explanation of Matthew 24 that we saw we're dealing with above, with reference to sun and moon and religious leaders and various interpretations there. Signs of the coming in the visible and invisible heavens, a sign of the Son of Man in heaven. Examples from the different dispensations. The mourning of the tribes coming in clouds, the meaning of heaven. Two kinds of knowledge. The heart must be cleansed from idle sayings, the meanings of clouds, smoke, and angels. The objections and differences which persist in every age. The alleged corruption of the texts and points related to that. The everlasting morn is breaking, another one of these rapturous passages. 3 degrees of perception of truth. The holy realm of the spirit, the sacred domain of truth, and the land of testimony. The exhortation to the people of the Bayan. The consummation of all things is belief in the promised one. On page 49, we have the example of the changing of the Qibla, I think, or this is at least the first reference to Qibla, whether nice to do that. Bottom of page 49. And likewise, reflect upon the revealed verse concerning the Qibla. When Muhammad, the son of prophethood, had fled from the dayspring of Bata unto Yasrib, he continued to turn his face while praying unto Jerusalem, the holy city, until the time when the Jews began to utter unseemly words against him, words which, if mentioned, would ill befit these pages and would weary the reader. Muhammad strongly resented these words, and whilst wrapped in meditation and wonder, he was gazing toward heaven, he heard the kindly voice of Gabriel saying, "We behold thee from above, turning thy face to heaven, but we will have thee turn to a Qibla which shall please thee." On a subsequent day, when the Prophet, together with his companions, was offering the noontide prayer and had already performed two of the prescribed rakats, the voice of Gabriel was heard again, "Turn thou thy face towards the sacred mosque." In the midst of that same prayer, Muhammad suddenly turned his face away from Jerusalem and faced the Kaaba, whereupon a profound dismay seized suddenly the companions of the Prophet. Their faith was shaken severely. So great was their alarm that many of them, discontinuing their prayer, apostatized their faith. Verily, God caused not this turmoil, but to test and prove his servants. Otherwise, he, the ideal king, could easily have left the Qibla unchanged and could have caused Jerusalem to remain the point of adoration unto his dispensation, thereby withholding not from that holy city the distinction of acceptance which had been conferred upon it. He goes on in explanation, he says, "None of the many prophets sent down since Moses was made manifest as messengers of the word of God, such as David, Jesus, and others among the more exalted manifestations who have appeared during the intervening period between the revelation of Moses and Muhammad, ever altered the law of the Qibla. These messengers of the Lord of creation have one and all directed their peoples to turn under the same direction. In the eyes of God, the ideal king, all the places of the earth are one and the same, excepting that place which in the days of his manifestations he doth appoint for a particular purpose, even as he hath revealed, 'The east and the west are God's, Therefore, whichever way ye turn, there is the face of God. Notwithstanding the truth of these facts, why should the Qibla have been changed, thus casting such dismay amongst the people, causing the companions of the Prophet to waver, and throwing so great a confusion into their midst? Yea, such things as throw consternation into the hearts of all men come to pass only that each soul may be tested by the touchstone of God, that the true may be known and distinguished from the false. Thus hath he revealed after the breach amongst the people. We did not appoint that which thou wouldst have to be the Qibla, but that we might know him who followeth the apostle from him who turneth on his heels. Affrighted asses fleeing from a lion. Both of these are Quranic verses. Were you to ponder but for a while these utterances in your heart, you would surely find the portals of understanding unlocked before your face, and would behold all knowledge and the mysteries thereof unveiled before your eyes. Such things take place only that the souls of men may develop and be delivered from the prison cage of self and desire. Otherwise, that ideal king hath throughout eternity been in his essence independent of the comprehension of all beings, and will continue forever in his own being to be exalted above the adoration of every soul. A single breeze of his affluence doth suffice to adorn all mankind with the robe of wealth, and one drop out of the ocean of his bountiful grace is enough to confer upon all beings the glory of everlasting life. But inasmuch as the divine purpose has decreed that the true should be known from the false and the sun from the shadow, he hath therefore in every season sent down unto mankind the showers of tests from his realm of glory. There's some notes here that may give you some background on these points. With regards to the Qibla, Qibla is the point of adoration in prayer. I think you're familiar with that. The direction toward which the faithful turn. In Islam, the Qibla was changed from Jerusalem to Mecca. The original Qibla mentioned in this paragraph was the House of Worship, the Holy of Holies, built by the Israelites in Jerusalem, and which became the center of Jewish worship. The faithful used to turn toward it when offering their prayers. It remained the direction of prayer from the days after Moses and during the time of Christ until it was altered by Muhammad. The Bab again changed the Qibla by appointing him whom God shall make manifest as the point of adoration. This point of prayer was to move with him, in other words, Baha'u'llah, until his passing, was the point of adoration. And then it was to be fixed at his resting place. His holy shrine now constitutes the Qibla, in accordance with the directions of the Bab. Baha'u'llah confirmed this law in the Kitab-i Aqdas, and that, of course, then fixed Baji as the Qibla for the Baha'i world. Bata under Yathrib is a reference to Muhammad's Hijra, his immigration from Mecca to Medina, in the 53rd year of his life. Abdu'l-Bahá states, the departure of Muhammad, the beloved of God, from the city of his birth was the cause of the exaltation of God's holy word. The meaning of Hijra is less geographical transference than separation and severance from family and kin. Bata is the central quarter and lowest part of Mecca. If you want to note that, that question comes up, and sometimes it's not easy to find explanations in Western books about it. Bata is the central quarter and lowest part of Mecca that lies in a hollow close around the Kaaba, Islam's most sacred shrine. The Kaaba is the cube, the block in the center of the mosque there in Mecca. This particular quarter was inhabited by the 10 main clans of the Quraysh, the aristocracy of the oldest families of Islam and of Mecca. Shortly after Muhammad reached Yathrib, which is the original name of Medina, its name was changed to the city of the Prophet, Al-Madinah An-Nabi. Now the An-Nabi means the Prophet part. That got dropped, and it just became known as Medina, the city. The mention, you'll notice here, of rakat see, where's this? Page 50. They'd already performed two of the prescribed rakats. It says here prostration. That's kind of a shorthand explanation of it. It's actually a set of genuflections in the obligatory prayer of the Muslims. It sometimes changes in contents depending on the time of the day. It includes the prostration, but it also includes other genuflections, bowing and so forth. The whole of one of these forms a basic element of Muslim obligatory prayer, and there were a number of them prescribed in Islam. The Bab has given 19 rakat in his obligatory prayer, although you don't have the obligatory prayer of the Bab, but we have that mention in the Bayan. And Baha'u'llah in the Akdas prescribes 9 rakat. 9 of these, so divided into 3 times a day. That prayer also we don't have, because it was sent away, and the copy that was to have come into Abdul Baha's possession was presumably in the satchel that the covenant breakers stole. But it had long since, some years before, been superseded by the 3 obligatory prayers that we have today. Baha'u'llah mentions, when stating 9, that God has wanted to reduce the burden, so to speak, on the people of obligatory prayer. He had reduced it from 19 that the Bab had specified to 9. And this is typical of modifications that Baha'u'llah has introduced into the laws of the Bab in the Akdas. Rakat, or plural, rekaat, which you will see when you have the Akdas in hand. The Kaaba itself, this cube-like building in the center of the sacred mosque at Mecca, was founded by Abraham, and that's considered the most holy shrine of Islam. It takes priority over Muhammad's resting place in a mosque in Medina. Now, you see how the Qibla there was separate from the shrine of the manifestation, whereas in the Baha'i dispensation now they've come to be the same. An interesting allusion on page 51 at the bottom. He says that in the eyes of God, the ideal king, all the places of the earth are one and the same, excepting that place which in the days of his manifestations he doth appoint for a particular purpose. There's some explanation from Abdul Baha about this sort of Effendi, I think. It's from a letter here. Let's see. As stated here, all the face of the earth is the same in the sight of God, with the exception of those places singled out by the manifestations of God. Physically, these sites, these temples and holy houses, both during and after their relationship to God's messengers, are the same. Shoghi Effendi has written through his secretary in a similar connection with regard to the physical remains of the manifestations. The atoms of the prophets are just atoms, like all others, but the association of this great spiritual power with them leaves in the place they are laid to rest a spiritual atmosphere. If one can use this expression, they are no doubt endowed with a tremendous spiritual influence and far-reaching power, but the physical character of their atoms are not different from other people's, any more than their bodies and physical functions are different. You can find this in Lights of Guidance, page 377. I'll give you the date of the letter. It's 28 October 1949. Because there's 2 editions of Lights of Guidance, the page numbering differs. There's a reference here also to Moses, son of Imran. Now, in the usages here, in the scriptures in the East, sometimes someone is called the son of someone. It doesn't mean they're literally their son. Moses is not the son of Imran. The meaning of this, if we look for the meaning of Imran, or Amran, sometimes in the Bible, his descendants include Moses and Aaron. and they constitute a subdivision of the priestly Levite. Levites, he is not literally the father of Moses. Which takes us into the next section here. The story of Moses and his homicide. In the course of this explanation, he says they sojourned in Midian. Midian is a district on the eastern side of the Gulf of Aqaba, extending north to the mountains east of the Dead Sea and west into the Sinai Peninsula. This was occupied by the descendants of Midian, the son of Abraham and Keturah. And they were in the service of Shoaib. Shoaib is a messenger of God sent to the Arab people of Midian. You can find references to him in the Quran. And also there's a brief reference here. While returning, Moses entered the Holy Veil, page 54. Situate in the wilderness of Sinai, and there beheld the vision of the King of Glory from the tree that belongeth neither to the east nor to the west. There he heard the soul-stirring voice of the Spirit speaking from out of the kindled fire, bidding him to shed upon Pharaonic souls. If you have Pharaohic souls, it should be corrected to an N from an H. In some of the older editions, you may have that. Pharaonic. House called attention to that on the 14th of January 1988. Bidding him to shed upon the Pharaonic souls, the followers, in other words, of Pharaoh, the Egyptians, the light of divine guidance, so that liberating them from the shadows of the valley of self and desire, he might enable them to attain the needs of heavenly delight, and delivering them to the Salsabil of renunciation, from the bewilderment of remoteness, caused them to enter the peaceful city of the divine presence. When Moses came unto Pharaoh and delivered unto him, as bidden by God, the divine message, Pharaoh spoke insultingly, saying, Art thou not he that committed murder and became an infidel? Thus recounted the Lord of Majesty as having been said by Pharaoh unto Moses, What a deed is that which thou hast done? Thou art one of the ungrateful. And so forth. And he talks about pondering thy heart, the commotion which God stirreth up. Reflect upon the strange and manifold trials with which he doth test his servants. Consider how he hath suddenly chosen from among his servants and entrusted with the exalted mission of divine guidance him who was known as guilty of homicide, who himself had acknowledged his cruelty and for well nigh 30 years had in the eyes of the world been reared in the home of Pharaoh and been nourished at his table. Was not God, the omnipotent King, able to withhold the hand of Moses from murder, so that manslaughter should not be attributed unto him, causing bewilderment and aversion among the people? Likewise reflect upon the state and condition of Mary. So deep was the perplexity of that beauteous countenance, so grievous her case, that she bitterly regretted she had ever been born. To this beareth witness the text of the sacred verse, wherein it's mentioned that after Mary had given birth to Jesus, she bemoaned her plight and cried out, Oh, would that I had died ere this, and been a thing forgotten quite. I swear by God, such lamenting consumeth the heart and shaketh the being. Such consternation of soul, such despondency could have been caused by no other than the censure of the enemy and the cavillings of the infidel and perverse. Reflect, what answer could Mary have given to the people around her? How could she claim that a babe whose father was unknown had been conceived of the Holy Ghost? Therefore did Mary, that veiled and immortal countenance, take up her child and return unto her home. No sooner had the eyes of the people fallen upon her than they raised their voice, saying, O sister of Aaron, thy father was not a man of wickedness, nor unchaste thy mother. And again meditate upon this great convulsion, this grievous test. Notwithstanding all these things, God conferred upon that essence of the Spirit, who was known amongst the people as fatherless, the glory of prophethood, and made him his testimony unto all that are in heaven and on earth. Behold how contrary are the ways of the manifestations of God as ordained by the King of creation to the ways and desires of men. Now, of course, all of this is to help the believers, to help the Muslims and the Babis and so on to recall, to understand that the various events that are taking place with regard to the Qa'im that they knew in their traditions weren't necessarily going to be literally fulfilled. And in fact, some of the things that happened to the Qa'im, they may have felt didn't align with the prophecies related to the Qa'im exercising sovereignty over the whole face of the earth. After all, he was taken prisoner, he was incarcerated in Maku and again in Cherik, and finally he was executed. So they had trouble getting these two things together. These again are part of the same test that Baha'u'llah is talking about here. And we have to see that pattern and understand how it affected the people at that time. Now, in the second part of the Qur'an, he goes into the spiritual meaning of the sovereignty that this question raises. The tree that belongeth neither to the east nor to the west, you know about that? This is the divine lote tree, the Sadratul Muntaha. It's also, its model is an olive tree. From its fruit it gives forth oil. The oil burns, except it says it's so special, this oil, that it burns without lighting. It's luminous in itself. Shoghi Effendi uses this same image to speak about the history of progressive revelation, the coming of the manifestations of God in the whole Adamic cycle. And he says that this young plant grew and put forth its stems and its branches and its leaves and its fruitlets until the perfect fruit appeared on the tree that's neither the east nor the west, in the person of His Holiness the Bab. And he said, then that fruit was plucked by the hand of destiny from this tree and was ground in the mill of adversity until it gave forth its pure oil. And it's this oil that became ignited in the being of Baha'u'llah and the Sayyid Chal. So you have this whole tree coming forth, bringing its fruit, and then the fruit of that tree being this oil, and then that luminous oil being lit within the being of Baha'u'llah, the lamp of His revelation. And then he goes further than that and he says that this flame, which was hidden by the clouds of divine purpose, until finally Baha'u'llah in Adrianople proclaimed his mission openly. And Shoghi Effendi likens that to placing a globe over a flame. You know, it steadies the flame and the light gets brighter. And then he talks about the propagation of that same light from Akka and through the instrumentality of the covenant to the different continents of the world, what he calls the diffusion of the light. And then he speaks about the successive stages of suffusion and penetration of that same light of Baha'u'llah, the light of the seed of the fruit of the tree of divine guidance down through the centuries, in the successive epochs and ages, age of the Baha'i dispensation, now through the formative age and into the golden age. We are now on the threshold of having witnessed the diffusion of the divine light to all countries. Now we begin to see this stage of suffusion, where it penetrates into the life of these communities, not only is over their heads and accessible to them, but is drawn into their beings and becomes part of the fabric of their societies. And we witness then gradually the birth of Baha'i nations, large Baha'i communities and so on. This is derived originally from a Quranic passage, and I'll read this. This has been cited in the Tablets of the Divine Plan, page 60, by the Master. It's the source of this thing. So God is the light of heaven and earth. The similitude of His light is a niche in a wall wherein the lamp is placed, and the lamp enclosed in a case of glass. The glass appears as if it were a shining star. It is lighted with the oil of a blessed tree, an olive neither of the east nor of the west. It wanteth little but that the oil thereof would give light, although no fire touched it. This is the light added unto light. God will direct unto his light whom he pleaseth. The message that I'm talking about, you could find that Shoghi Effendi describes this process in Messages to the Baha'i World, 1950 to 1957, pages 153 and 154. Shoghi Effendi gives the full description of 8 parts of this process that's taking place in the world and which connects us now, besides the 2 stages that we spoke about. 10 parts to the process and all. We're in the 10th part of the process now. Again, we have another reference in the original, the top line of page 55, the peaceful city of the Divine Presence is again Darul Salam. You remember previous classes we were talking about the appearance of this reference, which relates back to the prophecies of Baghdad and so on. Mary, the case of Mary. Shoghi Effendi, you'll remember in the list of themes of the Egon, let's see what the exact wording is here. Upholds the purity and innocence of the Virgin Mary. Virgin Mary, the Mother of Jesus Christ. The characterization of the Mother of Jesus throughout this passage has been singled out as one of the major themes of the Egon. We should compare this with God, with Promise Day Has Come, page 109, where Mary is described as that veiled, that immortal, that beauteous countenance. The reference on page 56 to a babe whose father was unknown. There are several letters of Shoghi Effendi about this, which bring us into other themes that are helpful to us to know in our teaching work. With regard to your question concerning the virgin birth of Jesus, on this point, as on several others, the Baha'i teachings are in full agreement with the doctrines of the Catholic Church. This is Shoghi Effendi, through his secretary. In the Kitab-e-Egon, page 56, and a few other tablets still unpublished, Baha'u'llah confirms, however indirectly, the Catholic conception of the virgin birth. Also, Abdu'l-Baha, in some answered questions, chapter 12, page 73, explicitly states that Christ found existence through the Spirit of God, which statement necessarily implies, when reviewed in the light of the text, that Jesus was not the son of Joseph. Again, first regarding the birth of Jesus Christ, in the light of what Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Baha stated concerning this subject, it is evident that Jesus came into this world through the direct intervention of the Holy Spirit, and that consequently his birth was quite miraculous. This is an established fact, and the friends need not feel at all surprised, as the belief of the possibility of miracles has never been rejected in the teachings. What is it that we say about miracles? We don't reject miracles, but what is it said in the teachings about miracles? Only good for people that see it. Mm-hmm. What else? Anything else? The words of God, the verses of God are a gracious miracle. Okay. What about miracles themselves? Hmm? They're not, in this day, they should not constitute a proof of the revelation. Exactly. Yeah. So that we shouldn't try to prove Baha'u'llah to people by mentioning miraculous events related to him. In fact, Baha'u'llah strongly condemns this in verses in Epistle to the Son of the Wolf. It demeans him to say these things as a means of attracting the attention of the people. And of course, if you haven't seen it yourself, and then Baha'u'llah in another place, in Abdu'l-Baha also confirms this, even people who've seen the miracles didn't accept. I mean, it doesn't become a convincing thing for them either. How many souls saw the miracle of the martyrdom of the Bab? It says 10,000 or so. How many responded after seeing such an extraordinary thing happen? So he says that his birth was quite miraculous. This is an established fact, and the friends need not feel at all surprised, as the belief in the possibility of miracles has never been rejected in the teachings. Their importance, however, has been minimized. This is from Lights of Guidance. What science calls a virgin birth, we do not associate with that of Jesus Christ, which we believe to have been a miracle and a sign of his prophethood. In this manner, we are in entire agreement with the most orthodox church views. Now, there were those that wrote and said, you know, there was an article in Life magazine about the virgin birth of turkeys, for example. And they said, oh, now we have scientific evidence of how it happened with Jesus Christ. And this was the answer of the Guardian on that subject. You know, don't look for some fluke in nature. This was through the intervention of God. That's what he says, and that's what we should believe. It would be sacrilege for a Baha'i to believe that the parents of Jesus were illegally married and that the latter was consequently of an illegal union. Such a possibility cannot be even conceived by a believer who recognizes the high station of Mary and the divine prophethood of Jesus Christ. It is this same false accusation which the people of his day attributed to Mary that Baha'u'llah indirectly repudiated in the Agam. The only alternative, therefore, is to admit that the birth of Jesus has been miraculous. The operation of miracles is not necessarily irrational or illogical. It does by no means constitute a limitation of the omnipotence of God. The belief in the possibilities of miracles, on the contrary, implies that God's power is beyond any limitation whatsoever. For it is only logical to believe that the Creator, who is the sole author of all the laws operating in the universe, is above them, and can, therefore, if he deems it necessary, alter them at his own will. We as humans cannot possibly attempt to read his mind and to fully grasp his wisdom. Mystery is therefore an inseparable part of true religion, and as such should be recognized by the believers. We cannot explain everything, and we should not feel embarrassed because of that. Simply state, there are certain things that are miraculous, there are other things that are mysterious, we don't know the answer to them. And someone said, but Shoghi Effendi, what's the explanation? He said, if there was an explanation, it wouldn't be a mystery. It's a mystery. The station of Abdu'l-Baha, he said, is one of the mysteries of the Baha'i faith. The station of the Imam Hussein, that Baha'u'llah should claim to be the return of the third Imam of these, you know, really successors, not of a prophetic rank, in Islam, that Baha'u'llah should choose to identify his soul with the Imam. This is a mystery too. Why? What was it, the quality of Hussein, that he chose this and actually bears his name, Hussein Ali? And another one, he says, again, with regard to your question relative to the birth of Jesus, he wishes me to inform you that there is nothing further he can add to the explanation he gave you in his previous communication, which is the previous one I just read. Regarding this point, one thing, however, he wishes again to bring to your attention, namely that miracles are always possible, even though they do not constitute a regular channel whereby God reveals his power to mankind. To reject miracles on the ground that they imply a breach of the laws of nature is a very shallow, well-nigh a stupid argument, inasmuch as God, who is the author of the universe, can in his wisdom and omnipotence bring any change, no matter how temporary, in the operation of the laws which he himself has created. The teachings do not tell us of any miraculous birth besides that of Jesus. That's also cited in Lights of Guidance, page, or the number actually is 982. I think this is a subsequent edition since these notes were put together, so you'll have to search around a little and find it. And there's one more letter from the Guardian. This is, as far as I know, unpublished. It says, the Master clearly writes in a tablet that Jesus was not begotten in the ordinary way, but by the Holy Spirit. So we must accept this. Every faith has some miracles, and this is the great miracle of the Christian faith. But we must not let it be a test to us. Our human minds are so small and as yet so immature compared to the men of the future that we should have no difficulty in acknowledging the power of God when he chooses to show it in some manner, quote, illogical, unquote, to us. Now, when Abdu'l-Bahá is faced with this, because some of the seekers and others would say, but Baha'u'llah is not born of a virgin, or he was born in an ordinary way, but Christ was born of a virgin. And then you remember Abdu'l-Bahá gives this explanation very beautifully. He says that if the greatness of Christ rests in the fact that he only had a mother, then we should be worshippers of Adam. The Bible tells us had neither a father nor a mother. And then they move on to other subjects, I presume. On page 60, there's a reference which. Let's see what that is now. Turn back to 59. Okay. Where's Andisha? Are you here, Andisha, someplace? You want to read a little first? My throat's getting dry here. This is this beautiful passage that's quoted here. Great God, starting with Great God on page 59. Over to 161. This is the passage about the universe is pregnant and stream of other information. Mm-hmm.
Great God, when the stream of utterance reached this stage, we beheld, and lo, the sweet savors of God were being wafted from the dayspring of revelation, and the morning breeze was blowing out of the Sheba of the eternal. Its tidings rejoiced anew the heart and imparted immeasurable gladness to the soul. It made all things new and brought unnumbered and inestimable gifts from the unknowable friend. The robe of human praise can never hope to match its noble stature, and its shining figure, the mantle of utterance, can never fit. Without word, it unfoldeth the inner mysteries, and without speech, it revealeth the secrets of the divine things. It teaches lamentation and moaning to the nightingales, warbling upon the bough of remoteness and bereavement, instructeth them in the art of love's ways, and showeth them the secret of heart surrender. To the flowers of the Rizwan of heavenly reunion, it revealeth the endearments of the impassioned lover and unveileth the charm of the fair. Upon the anemones of the garden of love, it bestoweth the mysteries of truth, and within the breasts of lovers, it entrusteth the symbols of the innermost subtleties. At this hour, so liberal is the outpouring of its grace that the Holy Spirit itself is envious. It hath imparted to the drop the waves of the sea and endowed the mote with the splendor of the sun. So great are the overflowings of its bounty that the foulest beetle hath sought the perfume of the musk and the bat the light of the sun. It has quickened the dead with the breath of life and caused them to speed out of the sepulchres of their mortal bodies. It has established the ignorant upon the seats of learning and elevated the oppressor to the throne of justice. The universe is pregnant with these manifold bounties, awaiting the hour when the effects of its unseen gifts will be made manifest in this world, when the languishing and sore thirst will attain the living corsair of their well-beloved, and the erring wanderer, lost in the wilds of remoteness and nothingness, will enter the tabernacle of life and attain reunion with his heart's desire. In the soil of whose heart will these holy seeds germinate? From the garden of whose soul will the blossoms of the invisible realities spring forth? Verily I say, so fierce is the blaze of the bush of love burning in the Sinai of the heart, that the streaming waters of holy utterance can never quench its flame. Oceans can never allay this Leviathan's burning thirst, and this phoenix of the undying fire can abide nowhere save in the glow of the countenance of the well-beloved. Therefore, O brother, kindle with the oil of wisdom the lamp of the Spirit within the innermost chamber of thy heart, and guard it with the globe of understanding, that the breath of the infidel may extinguish not its flame, nor dim its brightness. Thus have we illuminated the heavens of utterance with the splendors of the sun of divine wisdom and understanding, that thy heart may find peace, that thou mayest be of those who, on the wings of certitude, have soared unto the heaven of the love of their Lord, the All-Merciful.
Allah revealing the divine energies of his revelation of the world and yet having not declared his prophetic mission. The universe pregnant with these manifold bounties. One of the tablets of Abu Bai speaks about the gifts of the Spirit, the bounties of the Spirit, circle the human soul, awaiting capacity to enter therein, to confirm the soul. And he says this is similar to the powers of the soul that circle around the embryo in the womb, awaiting the appearance of those capacities so that the powers of the soul can enter into the embryo, into the child. And of course this continues right up to puberty and the stages of rationality, the higher stages of rationality. The soul is still making progressive appearances within the body in accordance with the capacity that's there. So likewise, society receives the benefits and bounties of the Holy Spirit in a progressive manner. As it creates capacity to receive those blessings, then they will appear and animate human society. And this is why it's so important that the mass of the people of the world gradually be transformed spiritually, so that all of these great gifts and bounties that Baha'u'llah and the Bab have instilled into creation can make their appearance. And we will see then the flowering and fruit of a divine civilization, the like of which we haven't had in the past. And we've had measured revelations, we've had great civilizations arising because of it. But you can imagine what the influence, what kind of arts and sciences and developments will come about through nearly 50 years of continuous revelation by the King of the Messengers of God and the supreme universal manifestation of the whole half million years of the cycle that we're in. So we need to do our part to the best, to the degree that we can, to become instruments of that power. And we don't have to be mighty and powerful to do it. We have to be humble and submissive to the will of God. And then, of course, he exercises his purpose through us. He reveals all of those things that are latent within our souls and prepared to be manifested by us. There is a course and of appointment and destiny for each soul. If we adhere to the will of God to the best that we can, if we follow the with that of Baha'u'llah, The distinction drawn here conforms to the principle of progressive revelation. In Islam, the spirit was called the faithful spirit, Ruhul Amin. They're all expressions of the one same spirit, which has had these different titles in different stages of its expression through different manifestations. Leviathan, do you know what a Leviathan is? Some of you whose English may not be your first language. This is an aquatic animal, real or imaginary, of enormous size. Figuratively, it is a creature of vast and formidable power. So we say Leviathans. Oceans can never allay this Leviathan's burning thirst. And this phoenix of the undying fire can abide nowhere save in the glow of the countenance of the well-beloved. The phoenix of the realms above crieth out from the immortal branch, the glory of all greatness belongeth to God. There's lots of references to the phoenix in the writings. The Oxford Dictionary defines phoenix as a mythical bird of gorgeous plumage, fabled to be the only one of its kind, and to live 500 or 600 years in the Arabian desert, after which it burnt itself to ashes on a funeral pile of aromatic twigs, ignited by the sun and fanned by its own wings, only to emerge from its ashes with renewed youth to live through yet another cycle of years. It's been used figuratively for a person of unique excellence and beauty. You have to examine it in different contexts in the holy writings to see what purpose it might have in those passages. Now, up to page 61, do you have other questions that you wanted to ask or clarifications? Anyone have anything that they have pending that they wanted to ask about? Please. Yes. Yes, it's interesting. On the one hand, the Bible affirms that Joseph is not his father, but he gives his genealogy just so you'll know who he is. It's a curious combination of elements. Of course, they knew the genealogies of the people. I mean, this was important to the Jews. And they traced themselves back to Abraham. That genealogy, I should think, is useful for... It has a divine wisdom in that it establishes that Jesus is not of the stem of Jesse. Because the prophecy in the Old Testament talks about the promised one, and in fact the Christ, coming from the stem of Jesse. And the issue of Jesse. So we know that Baha'u'llah is descended through that line. And have indications of how this is connected. And he affirms that this is the case. So that there's that aspect to help in proving that Christ couldn't claim to be that particular appearance of the Spirit. He is an appearance of the Spirit. As far as we know, I don't know, the genealogy of Mary is given there too, I think. She's of the Levites again. The sister of Aaron is indicative of her being of that, the group of the Levite priests, priest clan of Judaism. Also that top of page 57, O sister of Aaron, where she's referred to that way. Page 57, I have another note on that, I think, here. The traditions say that She was of the priestly class of Judaism, and hence she is addressed in the Quran as sister of Aaron, and again Baha'u'llah repeats that here. She's said to have been devoted to temple services from the ages of 3 to 12 years of age. The term sister is used here in the broad sense to denote Mary's lineal relationship to Aaron and not the fact that she had a brother named Aaron. That's about all I know about that one. Has anyone else heard any explanations about that? Or another question? Please.
I have a problem then when Baha'u'llah is telling the date with one of the greatest prophets.
Yes, this is interesting. Of course, we see that the Psalms have been constitute revelation verses of God. And he's the revealer of the Psalms. So he has a book in a sense, although he doesn't have laws. He didn't renew the laws. But he had a special book of verses. And he's treated as a full manifestation of God in the Quran as well. There is a second David, an earlier David. Let's see. In the Dawn of the New Day, you can find a reference to him. This David referred to here is the son of Jesse, who is the second king of Israel. For reference to an earlier David, see Dawn of a New Day, page 86, pages 86 and 93. Shoghi Effendi draws some interesting points there about his identity. Okay, any other points? Please.
It seems that the story that's told about Mary in this doesn't really conform very much with what's in the New Testament. There's just lamenting here, and in the New Testament, the way that I remember it, the angel Gabriel comes and asks her if she will accept him. The only thing we can take from the New Testament is being accurate in the early life of, in that period, is the actual virgin birth.
Well, I think that one has to take the passages in the Quran. There's a chapter on Mary in the Quran, and look at that in its full context. It seems to me there are also references to her having had an angel announce to her the event and the fact, but she still lamented because of the people. Which it seems to be the point I think that's being made here, is that she lamented because of the way the people criticized her. Oh, would that I were a thing forgotten. Not that she didn't want to bear Jesus, but that what a nuisance, what's happened, how people cursed her and everything. And there's a scene of her, and it seems to me in the Quran, where she's weeping and holding on to a date palm or something, how would you understand it if somebody on Hageffen Street started announcing such things to the people, This young girl says, well, I'm pregnant, and it's an angel that did it, I didn't know how, but that's the way it is. your mother was a decent woman. What's the matter with you? This is what she's saying. I mean, if you think the people were any different then than they are now, probably thicker of head. And then Joseph said, well, I don't know anything about it, myself, and it's a very interesting situation. And now this young, what people call people who are born without a father, this young fellow is a carpenter and so on. Now suddenly he's who? Mary's son? That fatherless child? In Judaism, who your father is, your name is based on who your father is. You're the son of so and so. Now he's the son of who? Son of Mary? That's why I keep saying, Jesus, son of Mary. This is an impossible kind of thing, to be called by your mother's name. He's the only one that has this name in Judaism, I'm sure. And that became, he's saying he's the Messiah? But we all remember the story, We don't even know who the boy's father is. Now he's going to be the promised one of the nation. See what kind of a test it is. Now, of course, the Christians say, this is the proof. Well, Jesus is who he says he is because he was born of a virgin and it's all wonderful and everything. They missed the point of what it was when it happened. So I think if you compare those two, you'll find other clues. In fact, it seems to me that in the Quran there's also mention of Christ speaking to Mary shortly after he was born. He spoke to her and said something to her. This is one of the miracles that the Quran attributes to Jesus, to the Christ child, speaking as a baby. And in the hadiths, there's many more. It's interesting because of the attitude the Christians have to the Muslims, you know, of not... not believing anything that they say, you know, that Muhammad is entirely false and so on. And yet the Muslims have to revere Jesus and revere Mary and accept this, the virgin birth also. I think it's the traditions of the Zoroastrians. Somebody's asked, do we have any affirmation in our teachings about the virgin birth of other prophets? We don't have any affirmations in our teachings, but in the traditions of both the Zoroastrians and the Buddhists, they say that they were born of virgins also. I mean, it's not something they borrowed from Christ because it's earlier, but they have it there. So startling from where Christian missionaries first teaching the Buddhists, you know, they go out and start talking about this and say, oh, maybe he is from God because Buddha was born of a virgin. Maybe he is an illumined leader. Okay. Now we have these signs in the visible heaven and the invisible heaven. A star on the one hand for the appearance of each of the manifestations. And on pages, 62, says among the prophets was Abraham, the friend of God. Ere he manifested himself, Nimrod dreamed a dream. Thereupon he summoned the soothsayers who informed him of the rise of a star in the heaven. Likewise there appeared a herald who announced throughout the land the coming of Abraham. Nimrod is the ancient king of Babylon. He's identified as the persecutor of Abraham. Nimrod dreamed a dream. In Bible dictionaries, Nimrod, the son of Cush, son of Ham, son of Noah, he traces his lineage, is described as a brave man, a hunter, a champion, a governor of the world, and builder of Babylon. Babylon for some time was called the land of Nimrod. Islamic traditions state that because he was nourished by a tigress at the order of God, he became known as Nimrod. Nimrod means tigress in Arabic. The account of Nimrod and Abraham and the throwing of the latter into the fire has been related by Majlisi, and we've already spoken about that episode of the fire. Accounts of Nimrod's dream, mentions the dream here, have been related in various books. One of them states, Nimrod was told by the priests that in the coming 2 or 3 years a child will be separated from his mother and your sovereignty will be demolished by him. Nimrod ordered to kill every child who became separated from his mother. This order was carried out for 3 years. It's been related that Nimrod had a terrible dream. He asked the wise men its interpretation. In interpreting it, one of them announced unto him the advent of Abraham. Some of the ancient accounts are contradictory in reporting this dream. One of them says that Nimrod's personal astrologer, Azar, dreamed the dream of his coming destruction. Majlisi, who relates in volume 14 of the Bihar's, the Bahar al-Anwar is a collection of Shia Islamic traditions. And this Majlisi is a famous compiler, and that's well known among students of Shia Islam. He relates in volume 14 that the Imam Sadek has stated that this Azar was Abraham's father and was the private astrologer of Nimrod. One night Azar understood from the arrangement of the stars that a boy would appear in that land who would destroy Nimrod and his followers. In the morning he informed Nimrod about this matter and said to him that very soon the seed of this boy will be fixed in the womb of his mother. Nimrod was astonished and asked whether the boy was already in the womb of the mother. Azar answered that it was not yet, and that Nimrod could order that men not cohabit with their women. And so it was that no man was allowed to be with husband. But Azar himself slept with his wife, and they themselves conceived Abraham. Azar, from the position of the stars, knew that they would burn his son, but he did not know that God would save him. These various traditions, contradictory and otherwise, but just so you have some idea of what the traditional view is of the subject. After him came Moses, he who held converse with God. Now you know he was supposed to have spoken to God in the burning bush. And Baha'u'llah identifies himself as the speaker on the mount, as the one that spoke out of the bush to Moses. But lest we should be confused by that spiritual identification, Jogi Effendi writes the following in a letter. He says, Baha'u'llah is not the intermediary between other manifestations and God. Each has his own relation to the primal source. But in the sense that Baha'u'llah is the greatest manifestation yet to appear, the one who consummates the revelation of Moses, he was the one Moses conversed with in the burning bush. In other words, Baha'u'llah identifies the glory of the Godhead on that occasion with himself. No distinction can be made amongst the prophets in the sense that they all proceed from one source and are of one essence, but their stations and functions in this world are different. This is cited in Unfolding Destiny, page 448. Well, I think the stories of Herod and John the Baptist are more familiar to you, although you may not know that in one of the World Order volumes, magazines, volume 9, numbers 2 and 4, there's a discussion about the prophethood of John the Baptist. John the Baptist had his own religious teachings before the appearance of Christ, and the Quran affirms that he was a messenger of God. Baha'u'llah says in the Epistle of the Son of the Wolf, they that have turned aside from me have spoken even as the followers of John the Baptist spoke, for they too protested against him who was the Spirit, Jesus, saying, the dispensation of John hath not yet ended, wherefore hast thou come? Epistle of the Son of the Wolf, page 157. And in the Kitab al-Badi, Baha'u'llah says, John appeared before Jesus, proclaiming his own prophethood, and all sects of Islam recognize him as a prophet, and he came with laws and commandments. This manifestation and that of the point of the Bayan, the Bab, are exactly similar to that of the son of Zechariah, John, and Jesus, the son of Mary. This is quoted from a tablet of Baha'u'llah cited in Asrar al-Asar, volume 4, page 233. Now, the difference here, of course, is that John the Baptist was not a co-manifestation with Christ, whereas the Bab and Baha'u'llah have been designated twin manifestations, and their two dispensations are co-mingled. In other words, Shoghi Effendi speaks about the dispensation of Baha'u'llah starting in 1944, the Baha'i dispensation starting in 1944, because in a sense, it takes in his dispensation takes in that of the Bab, because the Bab was his herald and also is the co-founder, if you will, of the Baha'i dispensation, and reigns with him supreme over the destinies of the whole of this period, and is one of the sources of infallible guidance to the friends and particularly to the Universal House of Justice, as affirmed in the Will and Testament of Abdu'l-Bahá. I've run out of time tonight. As Kamran said, we're still at the beginning. Next class, we'll go back to the questions for this second unit and answer a few of the points that are still to be remaining. And then we'll review the list of questions, and we'll have a list of questions, hopefully, for the beginning of part 2.